This podcast is part of the Gunna Geek Network. The opinions expressed may not represent other podcasts or affiliates of Gunna Geek. Check out more podcasts at GunnaGeek.com and get ready because geekness starts in 3, 2, 1.
Critics say we should be watching these movies.
But we're here to see if they're right.
Join us as we take a cinematic journey through independent and classic film.
So dim the lights.
And get ready for the show.
This is Art House Legends Podcast, where high art and geek culture collide. Daily Reminder Wednesday. Purchase Feeble Film Podcast Show and Exploited. Gee, I feel sorry for whoever that is. This is the Movie Dude Eric, and apparently I learned English from college and the Police Academy movies, and along with me are...
Hey, this is Kent here, and I'm a regular visitor here. But Art House Legends has certainly had its share of visitors. The French missionaries and explorers were coming here as early as the late 1600s to trade with the Native Americans.
And this is Chris. And first, you screw me, and then I screw you, and this podcast is all about Dutch door action.
And this episode, we're discussing Wayne's World, starring Mike Myers, Dana Carvey, Tia Carrere, Rob Lowe, Kurt Fuller, Brian Doyle Murray, and directed by Penelope Spheeris. Gentlemen, I honestly can't say that I ever thought that we would ever do Wayne's World, but thinking back on this movie and considering that from the moment I first saw this film when I was a wee lad, if I want to say about 11 years old, I love this movie.
Thank you for making me feel ancient.
Oh my god. So yes, we are talking about what could be possibly one of the most underrated comedies of the 90s. Maybe we'll get into that. But Kent, since you brought this up, how were you made aware of this movie? What is your familiarity with the material as it was prior to this film?
Oh,
are you a Saturday Night Live fan?
Well, this is going to get where I'm going to tangent before I come back. I know I'm going to tangent. So tangent warning! Whoa! But there's an argument among people who have watched Saturday Night Live, have been fans of Saturday Night Live, about what the best Saturday Night Live time period was. And it always boils down to when you really watched it, and it tends to be high school. So, 1989 is the first Wayne's World on SNL.
Mm-hmm.
And I vaguely remember seeing that. And then discussing it later when school resumed, because I think it was during winter break. So, that was just, you know, this period is, quote-unquote, my Saturday Night Live. That's like, this is the best ever. Well, it's going to be different for every generation, but yes, this is my SNL. So, bring it back to the movie Wayne's World. This movie came out my freshman year of college. I want to say this is the first movie that was not a Star Wars or Star Trek movie that I saw in theaters multiple times. And I vaguely have memories of watching this in summer, but it came out in March, so I don't remember how I watched it in summer unless it was in theaters that long. But I do remember watching it like 8 or 9 times. Yeah, in Fiat. Well, I'm thinking a lot of that might have been dollar show scenarios, but still, yes.
Hey, freshman in college, what else are you going to do?
Yeah, especially when it's like, hey, let's go, what are we going to do? Hey, Wayne's World's still over there. Yeah. Yeah.
Party on.
And somewhere in this house, it's on VHS.
Nice. Wow. What about you, Chris? Come on, let's age yourself a little bit. Where were you when you first saw this film? Or is this your first time?
I saw it way after the fact, because like, when the movie came out, I was 8. So, yeah. And I've never watched Saturday Night Live like regularly, so I didn't watch any of the original sketches, and I mean, I didn't see the film until, like, I think I saw it for the first time, like, less than 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I don't know, it's just kind of, I saw it way after the fact to begin with, and I'm seeing it way after mm-hmm. the fact again now, and it's just, I feel like I missed the prime moment to watch it when it was still fresh, you know?
I get you. Okay, so I got a little. I mentioned that I absolutely loved this movie when I saw it. I got to say mm-hmm. something. This was one of the very first occasions where a trailer absolutely did not do any favors for me until I actually saw the movie, and then when I saw it, I fell in love with it. Because I saw the trailer when I went and saw The Addams Family in theaters, and spoiler alert. I fucking love The Addams Family.
Yeah.
Just saying right now. I will argue that Addams Family is up there with Citizen fucking Kane when it comes to...
It is a finely crafted movie, so... Yeah.
It is. But that's going to be for a different podcast, probably about another year or two into the future. But Wayne's World, I saw the trailer, and it just looked like... Because I saw the trailers for this and I think Cool World at the same time. If I'm not correct. I could be wrong on that, but I do know that both trailers just did nothing for me. Like, ugh. And for Cool World, I fell asleep watching it every single time. I've never seen Cool World all the way through. I fell asleep every single time.
Ouch.
Every single time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but Wayne's World, it was one of those that... I really didn't want to get the, you know, it was the VHS rental type thing where everyone wanted to see it. And it's like, okay, fine, we'll see it. And I fell in love with it even more harder than the others. After the end of the movie, I was like, let's do this again.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved this movie. We'll see if that love still sticks around because it has been 25 years. It's,
God, yeah.
I'm point,
old! Okay. Give me my cane!
This movie could legally purchase alcohol and rent a car. Okay?
Yeah.
That's how old this thing is now. And so let's be honest here. This is definitely a movie of the 90s. So we're definitely going to have...
For me, it's an 80s movie, but that's because for me, decades don't switch over until like 1 or 2 years after the decade, quote unquote, begins on the calendar. But that's my view of dealing with time, because I remember in 1992 stuff like there's still poofy hairdos. I mean, you're not, if you've got the poof hairdo and you're a girl, you're still in the 80s, even if it's 1992.
No, this movie has got its heart not just in the 90s, but in the 80s and the 70s and
yes.
the 60s. This
yes.
thing, I mean, this thing is, while it is definitely planted in the 90s in a lot of its
yeah.
references, it's got so much homage to everything before it that it's kind of a hodgepodge. It's like one of the things that I didn't realize was just how much of the music that was in this movie that was playing to 80s and 70s music. I mean,
yes.
we have, what, two Jimi Hendrix songs in here? We have we have a couple of 80s tracks. We have Alice Cooper, who I think embodies the 80s specifically more than he does the 90s.
Yes.
Meatloaf, the 70s for Meatloaf. Yeah, this thing's got, it's all over the place. And I guess we should also go ahead and say that this is definitely the mindset of Penelope Spheeris, who is our director here. Penelope Spheeris has got an interesting biography. I don't know if you've ever gone through her IMDb page or if you've ever looked at what she's done. She is the embodiment of an independent filmmaker. She has been making practically indie kind of cult movies from the 60s. She was one, she actually worked on Saturday Night Live back in the 70s
yeah.
with, she was the one who did all the Albert Brooks shorts. Now, I've actually gone through and I watched the first 5 seasons of Saturday Night Live. So I actually got to see those shorts. I'm going to tell you right now, Albert Brooks shit
yeah.
is some of the best stuff that Saturday Night Live. Those were the original digital shorts of its period. And what Albert Brooks and apparently Penelope Spheeris did with those were just brilliant. That was real genius in that. And you could definitely see where Albert Brooks would go on to make movies of his own, and he would do a really great job at it. And I didn't know that it was Penelope Spheeris who was directing those specifically. But after she had done her thing on Saturday Night Live in the 80s, she got in big with the metal, with rock and roll and the metal scene. She did a trilogy of independent films called The Decline of Western Civilization, which was specifically on rock and roll. She did a couple of other films. I think one that stood up mostly for me was Dudes, which I haven't seen, but I'm actually kind of interested in seeing.
Let's put it on the list.
we'll see.
Okay.
But she has had a very wild ride when it comes to Hollywood and kind of indie Hollywood at that. But were you familiar with her stuff prior to this, or were you more familiar with the stuff that she did after this? Which after this, obviously, she made a whole bunch of studio comedies after this.
Well, after this, she did do Wayne's World 2, right?
Nope.
That was a different director. Okay.
No, Penelope Spheeris, we'll get into that, but let's just say that there's a reason why she didn't come back for that. But after this, she did the Beverly Hillbillies, she did the Little Rascals, which in my opinion is slightly underrated in itself. A lot funner than I think people give it credit for. She did a few other indie comics, and then she's kind of done more shorts more recently and kind of got into the digital age in itself. And of course, she did some TV here and there. But where are you familiar with her work, if you're familiar with her at all?
I didn't know she did those Albert Brooks skits. So, because I've seen a few of those.
Mm-hmm.
So, and
you know what I'm talking about. Those are really good.
Yeah.
Those are, like, exceptionally good.
And some of them aren't necessarily designed to be comedic either. I mean, they're just good work.
No, they are, but they're very cerebral. You have to understand that, especially considering the absurdity of Saturday Night Live comedy.
Yeah,
Albert Brooks's stuff was extremely cerebral. His stuff was it was a bit different for what Saturday Night Live was going, and you could definitely tell that after a while that they just decided that they wanted to kind of go on more of that kind of live scene instead of doing more shorts.
Yeah.
I think they would come back to doing shorts, I believe, actually around the time of Myers and Carvey. That's when the shorts came back.
So I can ambiguously gay duo the animated stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And then when Andy Samberg came, that's when they really went all the way in on that and on with the digital shorts. But I'm not a huge Saturday Night Live fan, and yet I feel like I'm the Saturday Night Live guru at this point.
I'm out of touch with SNL, so yeah, maybe so.
It was the class after Will Ferrell that I kind of lost touch. Not the Will Ferrell age. It was just after that I kind of missed out. Like, I haven't really seen much of the last three seasons, with the exception of a couple up here and there. But all right, so but back to Penelope Spheeris. Chris, are you familiar with any of her work?
Not at all.
All right. So let's go ahead and let's get deep into this motherfucker, because this is one wild and wacky ride. Okay, no matter if you like this film or don't like this film, this thing can be all wrapped up into one word, and I think we can all agree absurd is the best word to explain this movie, right? This is absurd.
Well, it made logical sense at the time, sort of, kind of, but not really.
Did it?
Really? Okay, I'm waiting to hear this one. Okay, try to make sense.
If you know, well, you have. I think a lot of this goes with the premise of knowing people who would do a cable access show. which is makes sense. And then you get a trail of events that is looks absurd, but not horribly out of the question. The only parts that are really absurd is, let me look at the camera and talk to you.
Okay, well, and we'll talk about the fourth wall breaks.
Yeah. Which, amazingly, are now just, you know, that's TV now, is half of its fourth wall breaks.
It's not just TV, though. If you really look at it, you can actually make a clear line draw from Wayne's World to the modern YouTube culture.
Yes, I was going to... You beat me to it. You beat me to it, because I was going to... Do we want to do that right now? Do you want to...
Well, public access television was the YouTube of its time.
Right.
If you had the money that you could shell out for a 30-minute block, you could make practically whatever you want, as long as you didn't, like, do anything really bad. Or, you know, if you had people, like, sending death threats to the public access channel. No Videodrome, obviously, you know.
Yeah. But you do have, let's find a YouTuber we can sponsor and get advertising on. Yeah. Well, YouTube already set that up internally,
not at first, but.
Yeah. 10 years ago, we would have said sort of a video podcast culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's predicting that at the same time, except we've advanced to YouTuber, but yeah, they're basically the proto YouTuber.
Basically this is the public sphere. This is an everyday person. I think that was the humor of the original Wayne's World sketch on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
Was the idea of just these couple of slacker metalheads who are just kind of dumb and the silly things that they will do on their little channel, which, again, considering, you know, also that this was a play on things like the Headbangers Ball time, and I probably even say that they would probably were taking pot shots at Beavis and Butthead at some point kind of having that same two dudes on a couch kind of
Beavis and Butthead is after the TV version of Wayne's World. So I want to say it doesn't hit till 90 or 91.
Well, the 92, though, I mean, we have to look at the film, because the film is not just taking the shorts. It's using the shorts as kind of a springboard for something bigger.
Right.
And... You know, because if you really look at it, I think with the exception of the suck and cut,
that was
the only thing that really came from the shorts. Because, you know, because the shorts themselves were just about the actual public access show. We only see two shows of the public access show in the film.
Well,
so the rest of this is off screen, off camera. In-world camera, because obviously we have the fourth wall breaks by how many characters? I want to say, four characters at one point or another break the fourth wall at some point?
At the end, they all kind of do, because they all, during Mega Happy Ending, they all look at the camera.
We'll get to that.
Yeah,
we'll get to that.
I think it's Wayne and Garth break the wall, Ed O'Neill's character.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
who's the fourth?
Yeah.
And the fourth was during the gloom and doom ending, Rob Lowe.
Oh,
breaks the fourth wall.
Okay.
We'll add, because the mega happy ending, everyone breaks it, but at the same point, we'll get into the endings specifically, because that was another thing. I'll tell you right now, what did it for me, the thing that absolutely made me love this movie as a kid, was the three endings. The fact that it played with the expectation of ending to that point. And even though I wasn't a film guru at the time, I will say, though, that it just hit a nerve for me. The fact that this is a movie that was so aware of itself that it could basically say, we'll do whatever the fuck ending we want to this movie, and you'll just have to accept it. And I thought that just that confidence. That takes a lot of fucking confidence, right? That's, you have to be very confident in your movie to do something like that. There's another movie that came out. I want to say it was Michael Haneke's Funny Games. Both his original and the remake did this thing in the middle of the film that I'm not going to spoil because there are people that want to hurt themselves. They can definitely watch that movie and feel really bad afterwards. Michael Haneke never makes a happy movie. I'll just tell you that right now. But he does something in the middle of his film, Funny Games, that kind of calls back to Wayne's World, which is weird for a torture porn type of movie.
I think I know what you're talking about, and involves
it has
a
something
remote
to do with a rewind button.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. I haven't seen it, but I heard that. So yes, I know what you mean.
Yes. But all the same, though, but I just the confidence that that this movie has on that level, and again, we'll get to the endings in just a bit, but. Again, this is something that you see straight from the beginning when we do have the fourth wall breaks, because fourth wall breaks is a – it's – you're running a gambit, because in a way you're letting everybody know that this is a movie. And so it does have that aspect, and people could be turned off by it or they can get into it. And I think that it really comes off of the confidence that the actors and the characters have, or that the film has about its characters. And here we have – Wayne and Garth is our main protagonists, and they are kind of funny. They're relatable to an extent. Or do you find them relatable? I guess I should ask before I make that assumption.
No, not really.
18 and 19-year-old me did, and I don't, and I'm not quite totally sure why, but yeah, which is odd because I never really got that the characters were almost 30 years old. I thought they were younger at the time, but watching it now, it's like, yeah, God, everybody in this movie is kind of way older than I thought.
Well, I would have taken them for late 20s, but yeah, they're definitely adult slackers. And that's one of the reasons why it doesn't feel awkward that Wayne and Garth are being portrayed by 30-year-old actors. That in a way that this is a movie acknowledging, yeah, these guys are older. Yeah, they're acting like they're teenagers. Yeah, there's a bit of Peter Pan elements going here, especially considering that one of them is definitely trying to hit on possibly one of the hottest women in Hollywood in that year. This is a play on some male fantasy shit, right? Just
and,
a little bit.
And Horbury underemployed at the same time. The only real guy we see of that group employed at a reasonable job is the guy who's drunk and or high every time we see him, except when he's at work. And he's got the good he's got the fairly good job. It's like, yeah, guys, this is your bill for the mechanic and blah, blah, blah. He's basically sounds like he's semi running that shop as the as giving them as billing. It's like, and you're the guy who's wasted all the time outside of work, which maybe they're saying something about, you know, yeah, having that job. Yep. Got to get escape. And but he needs coffee and crawlers stat.
All right. Well, Chris, you said that you don't find them relatable. What about these characters, do you find either interesting or that you find annoying? What kind of beat are you taking off these characters?
Well, my issue is I've never found Dana Carvey funny, like, ever. So, like, rewatching this just reminded me of that. I really don't like him, like, at all. So, like,
two words. Wow. That kind church lady. I'm sorry. I will have to say that if you don't find anything else that he does funny, church lady is hands down comedy genius. Just saying.
Church lady can be too close to home at times, but
just saying. I mean, I agree with you. For the most part, you know, Master Disguise, Clean Slate, he is not a very funny guy. He really isn't. Although I did enjoy his stand-up comedy. He does have his stand-up is really good, but
See, I tried to watch some stand-up for that he had on Netflix, like a recent one, and I couldn't even get through the whole thing. It was like, man, this is not funny at all.
The last time I saw him in stand-up, it was about 10 years ago, and I thought it was really funny, so maybe I'll have to check out the new stuff. Maybe it was just a fluke kind of thing. There's been some others that I'm starting to think that maybe it was a fluke, too. Amy Schumer.
Ouch. Yeah.
Yeah, we might have to have a conversation about that at some point. But here, though, I don't know. I mean, Dana Carvey, I'm not a fan of Dana Carvey in this film, but I will say, though, that Garth is a character that I can kind of understand. Maybe that's the character I can relate to on a personal level, although I don't really relate to a whole lot of characters. Probably because he's so introverted. He freaks out around the camera. He freaks out around people. He doesn't like being in the limelight, even though we do see that he has these kind of inner dreams, which I think that's the thing that I really like about the film does, is it shows us that this is a guy that's so uncomfortable with himself that he will practically sabotage himself. Yet when you see him in a zone where he feels comfortable, he is a god in that sense. You know, when he's on the drums and he's just riffing that drum solo. I mean, it's just, you know, when he's confident, he is capable of doing so much. You know, the Foxy Lady dream sequence, which isn't brilliant in itself, but it gives you a better idea of what this character is. It's a great character moment, if maybe not one of the funniest moments in the movie. But I really appreciate what they did with the character. And I think Dana did kind of bring something to that. But it really wasn't the humor, because he is very awkward and very uncomfortable. And uncomfortable can be as much a detractor to humor as it is sometimes capable of bringing humor along with that character. But I don't know. You, Kennedy, you wanting to fight me on this?
I remember at the time, and even a couple years later, he really hit home with some people I knew. I worked with a girl that did a perfect imitation of him. I mean, she'd walk up behind you holding something heavy and go, "Excuse me, I'm trying to get by now." And it was just like, oh my god, that's perfect. You're like, oh, that's perfect. Oh, sorry, you're holding something that weighs like 50 pounds. We'll get out of the way. Sorry.
I mean, I love the fact that, you know, this is the kind of guy that would put his glasses over the hockey mask.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Well, if you have the hockey mask over, it's going to push against your face and it's going to hurt. And that's going to be bad. You don't want your face to hurt. That would be bad.
You could go with some goggles or something.
But this is hockey.
I'm just saying, though. I mean, just imagine, you know, if Jason Voorhees had astigmatism and he needed to do the exact same thing.
Well, it is a good comedic joke just to do that. So I could see goggles over the glasses, over the mask. That would be.
but all the same, though. But, let's be honest here. The most charismatic character here is Wayne. He's also the biggest slacker. He's the one with the biggest dreams. You know, he's the most theatrical of the group. Of course, we'll get into his carpool karaoke in just a moment. Which I will say, one thing that I'm very glad about that is that it was my first introduction to Queen.
Really?
Yes, it was. I mean, I'd known about We Will Rock You to an extent, but I didn't really know who Queen was. And I will say this right now. Every single time that I'm in a car with Bohemian Rhapsody,
you gotta.
It happens.
Yes.
It happens.
It's because of this movie. So.
Yes. And I just the entire scene is just brilliant. It's a brilliant scene. It's fun. It's funny. It sets up the characters a bit. It allows We see who kind of runs things. We know kind of, you know, that Garth is kind of the second in command, but he's also kind of just, he's maybe the, you know, the, if we could say that, you know, that Wayne is the Johnny Carson, that Garth is the Ed McMahon of the group. You know, go back to the 80s a bit.
Yeah.
You could, you know, do Conan and Andy Richter if you want to, if you want to go a little bit more new. But, you know, that he's kind of the second in command. But what I also love about this, and that I noticed this time around, is just how much attention was given to the backup guys.
Yeah, because the crew, they don't exist on SNL, so they're just kind of invented for this. So, which makes sense, because there has to be a crew that is doing the tech side.
Well, so, I love that they have personality.
Yeah,
you know, they have their own minds. They you know, they have a few jokes on themselves. The camera guy who's hitting on the sponsor's wife. You know, are you scared of me? No, do you want to be scared of me? And the fact that it's Michael DeLuise playing that.
Yes.
I didn't realize that it was him, and I was watching 21 Jump Street at the time.
No, I didn't realize it was him until I rewatched now and went, dude, it's him from we'll geek sheet it later. But
I know which one you're wanting to talk about.
Oh yeah.
Yep,
because I just
was definitely in that one.
Because I just watched it a little bit ago, but
no, all of the guys. I mean, they all have humor, and yet there was the carpool karaoke that really shows them as a group. You know the whole headbanging thing, which I love this scene a lot. Do you want to take a hot shot at this one? Come on, bring it. I'm willing to go there.
Come on. It didn't affect me the same way. I'll leave it at that, I guess.
No, you're not going to Garth on this. You got to come out and play. Come out and play, all right? Got to do it.
I mean, I didn't see the movie when it was first out, so it didn't... I mean, I knew about Queen because my mom loved Queen, so like I already knew about him, and I didn't. I don't know. I don't have much to say about it. It just didn't affect me that way, I guess.
I get it. You, when you think of Queen, you think about that Suicide Squad trailer, huh? Is that it?
Oh no.
When I think of Queen, I think of Highlander. But that's my first exposure to Queen, really, is that movie. So, but for this, in both the director commentary and in one of the featurettes that was on the DVD I got, they talk about everybody in the scene hated it. Because they didn't think it was funny at the time. They didn't see, how are people going to like this? And Penelope sitting back going, this is hysterical. Do it. And
it was Mike. Mike Myers was the one.
Did not like it. But he also kept injuring himself during it. Because, let me tell you, as somebody who did this at the time, because this movie came out, everybody's doing this in the car. I mean, we're all doing it. Yeah, I could see after two, three takes of this, you going, ow, I can't redo this. My neck is killing me. They're doing 10 takes to make sure they got it right. And that's gotta be painful. I don't care how fun it is. Twice was probably, I'm old. So I hurt when I do it today. and still do it. But I could see it being an issue at times. So I'm going to start doing it right now. Yeah! Sorry about the chair. Okay, chair's making noise as I'm headbanging. Yeah! Okay.
When the chair comes,
I'll behave. Yeah, I'll behave. I'm in my happy place.
But again, what it does is it really does set up the group as a group. And on top of that, it has that real capper, because after the headbanging, we have the Excalibur, the introduction to Excalibur, this legendary guitar that will kind of play a part in Wayne's quest, and then afterwards we're going to get to the hockey themed donut shop, which I mean, how do I put this?
In a way, it makes sense for Chicago of that time, because the Bulls are not the Bulls. A Bears theme would make more sense, but this is Mike Myers, so of course it's got to be hockey.
No, it's hockey. No, this is Tim Hortons.
True.
This is intended to be a Canadian thing. They just planted it in Chicago.
Yeah.
Which I guess could work a bit, but let's be honest here. This scene would not work if not for the great Ed O'Neill.
Oh, yes.
I did not know that Ed O'Neill was in this movie. I didn't even really pay attention to the credits when I first saw it. So when Ed O'Neill showed up in that scene, and understand that Married with Children was banned.
Oh, really?
From my house. We couldn't watch it. And quite honestly, I'm still not a big fan of Married with Children. But I have to give it up to Ed O'Neill, because the guy just... He just embodies this kind of smart-ass kind of Chicago person. And now that I've seen a lot of his work, especially his work with we just talked about him too. David Mamet. You know, the guy is, you know, he's Shakespearean trained. I mean, this guy knows acting inside and out. And you know, he'll always be known for sitcoms. His timing here, and the fact that he is the third person to break the fourth wall, is like part of you just kind of accepts that with him. You know, he has that kind of personality that he'll find the camera.
But then he's put in his place right away. Wait, what are you doing? Only me and Garth could talk to the camera. Get. Yeah. Which is great. That in the theaters was the first time I was like, wow.
Well, both of his scenes,
yeah,
both scenes that he's in are really funny, and it's really up to him, because he's telling the story in both times.
Yeah.
He's giving you his personality, and it's a very homicidal personality. The kind of person who would think who would be running a coffee shop in Chicago.
At midnight, because it's basically midnight all these times that they're there. So, well, except during the day. Yeah, it is daytime once. But at night, yeah. Because they do Wayne's World at 10 o'clock. Yeah, I could see it being 11 o'clock midnight before they get there.
Well, that was 11 when they... It was 10:30 to 11, if I'm not correct.
Okay. That sounds right.
But yeah, so, yeah, it would still be... I would say it's a 24-hour spot, especially with the coffee. What Wayne's World does, and it's something I've really noticed in this particular screening, is that they recognize that Wayne is a small-time personality, that he does have people who know who he is. Yet, he's not so big that he is just universally loved. He's beloved by some people, but it's not something that's widespread. It's, you know, the if you're in the know, you know who this guy is. And that's something that I really respect about what this film does, because, like, a movie that really kind of annoyed me with the everybody loves character, first is Austin Powers, which gets really annoying, and then The Wrestler came out, I want to say almost about 10 years ago, and the way that everyone just loved this wrestler, even though he's been off his game for like 20 years, I just didn't understand it. Here it makes sense. It makes sense that because he is kind of a little known name, so people who are kind of into the metal scene, they'll know who he is, they'll respect him, they kind of, you know, that he does have a bit of a small celebrity status, right?
They've seen his show, so, yeah.
Well, even the cop sees his show, like,
yeah.
Even though he won't admit to it.
Well, I think the cop, I get the feeling that the cop probably watches the show and then goes on duty. And then they meet up, and then he just runs into him at the donut place all the time. Because that's where he gets his donuts, cop donuts, yes, joke. But right as he's going on duty, he gets his coffee and his donuts there, and it's like, it's him. Like,
but
eventually...
The cop that like, respects the fact that people make fun of cops. Yeah. The fact that he's willing to catch the joke and to kind of be okay with the joke about cops, it tells you something about this guy. And, of course, it pays off when, you know, he pulls out the rubber glove at the end.
Yeah.
Which, I'll be honest here, I didn't understand it at 11, but I didn't have to.
Yeah.
I didn't have to. It's just a funny enough thing in itself. You don't need to really understand it to find it funny. Although, now that you do understand what it is, it's even funnier.
Yeah.
But again, they just set up this cop character really well. They really do set him up very well, you know, with, you know, running into Wayne, kind of being friends with Wayne. Then he has the joke about how he's pulled over the entire tour bus and had to pull, you know,
body cavity searches. Yep.
You know, it sets that up so that when you see the rubber glove at the end, it is funny because you know what's going to happen. Is you couldn't have picked the perfect person for it to happen to, you know.
And, right. And Rob Lowe pays it off so well with his body acting.
Oh, my God. Let's go ahead and say right now. Rob Lowe is full game here. Say what you will about – this is because considering his status as kind of this, you know, heartthrob, you know, this big-time celebrity. You know, this was, you know, just before – just after his sex tape occurred. You know, he could have easily pulled a Lindsay Lohan – and kind of went diva. And no, he really brought his A game. He was fully game for what was happening here. And
this was really his first major thing after the scandal.
Yeah.
And it saved him. I think it's completely saved him. He comes back, he does this, he's able to stabilize a career, and
then West Wing.
West Wing, Parks and Rec, everything, yeah. So, well, reoccurring in Austin Powers for a couple years too, in those series. So, yeah.
I can forgive him for the Christmas shoes. That's saying something. If you've seen that piece of trash, you know that any other actor would be 6 feet under career wise after that, probably digging that hole themselves. But Rob Lowe has just enough charisma and workability, and the fact that he does work hard, you can tell that he is, again, this is a very self-effacing character. This is the kind of character that, you know, that the other actors would play and be worried about being the end of their careers, right? You know, this is kind of the William Atherton role. You know, bringing back our Die Hard and Ghostbusters movies on that one. But no, but he's capable of giving this guy some dignity, making him both a foil for Wayne, while at the same time also being kind of sympathetic in his own means, because he's not really that bad.
There's some questionable anything for a buck there, and he's a womanizer, which, okay. But
he's slimy, but at the same time, he's not a mustache twirling guy. I mean, Wayne does it to himself. If you really think about it, everything that happened, the bad that happens to Wayne, is his own damn fault. Everything. He sabotages himself. Rob Lowe, all he does is just give him the rope to hang himself with. He doesn't have to do shit. So we don't really want to see him be, you know, we don't want to see him get the real bad treatment. A body cavity search is perfectly fine for his transgressions. But, you know, we don't want to see him, like, being put out on the street. He doesn't deserve that. He's not that kind of villain. Or do you disagree with me on that?
Yeah. It feels like the argument would be he could be so much worse. He's not Darth Vader. He never thinks about killing someone. But, yeah, I think he puts some stuff on. He does a lot of stuff that he knows will piss off people and make them do bad things.
But what does he really do that makes people do bad things? I mean, well,
he forces the show to change format. He forces format changes that he knows.
Well, it has to happen. If it, The only way that Wayne's World was going to get any kind of funding was right. that it had to have a sponsor, and the sponsor was going to be Noah's Arcade. Now Noah is a piece of shit. Okay, Noah is the real bad guy here, because this is the guy that's basically outright not just admitting but gloating right. about the fact that he is basically stealing candy
stealing from a baby,
coins
yeah.
from kids. You know, this is an asshat, and he deserves the public ridicule that he gets. Rob Lowe is not that bad. All he's doing is he's giving Wayne an opportunity to branch out, and he's also looking at making money off of this transaction. He's really not doing anything awful here. Yeah, he uses the word exploit in his notes, but exploit is not always a bad thing. You know, that whenever you're making money off of anything, whether it's a noble thing or not, it's exploitative. Sorry. But no, I don't find him to be truly villainous. Not in the sense that we would normally see, and that would be played up way too much in the Wayne's World 2, as well as other SNL movies, where you have like this kind of cartoonishly evil bad guy. In fact, Benjamin is really just kind of, you know, he's pretty down to earth for the most part. You know, yeah, he tries to hit on Cassandra a little bit, but let's be honest here.
Who wouldn't? Yeah.
I'm sorry, but yeah, Cassandra is going to get hit on. And honestly, I also love the fact that both Wayne and Pat Benjamin both use their knowledge of Cantonese to get her attention. But let's be honest here, that first use of the Cantonese, I love that.
He can't learn it, so we'll just go to subtitles. And
well, what that reminded me of was kind of Whose Line Is It Anyway? At the same time, kind of an element of Looney Tunes with some of how they used subtitles in some of those Looney Tunes skits. I mean, yeah, so. I mean, it's absurd. It's crazy. It's goofy. And you know, especially that long sentence that was said with like what, four syllables, and again, it was just all of that just kind of was fun. But at the same time, that when Rob Lowe uses the Cantonese, all that's an immediate signifier. Oh shit, he's going after Cassandra. Oh, yeah. I mean, just that in itself.
And the only one who doesn't see it is Wayne. It's like,
oh no, Wayne sees it.
Yeah.
No, it's like that's the moment where he realizes, oh, this guy's good.
Yeah.
You know, he even outright calls it outright to the camera. But, you know, but what it was is that, but at the same time, that it was set up over scenes. You know, we see how Benjamin sees Cassandra. We see how Garth sees that this is a chick pad, you know, going into the bathroom and stuff. I thought that was kind of, you know, it's done in stages. So that when you get to these particular scenes, it, you know, it doesn't come out of left field, and it develops that comedy very precisely, which is something that, I don't know, maybe more modern comedies just, they don't feel like they don't have to do anymore. It's like gag, payoff, gag, payoff, gag, payoff. And it doesn't ever develop those gags like this film does, because it will take two or three scenes to develop the joke, the punchline, you know, that it'll set that up. Like we said with the cop sequence, you know, it takes two or three scenes for that to pay off. You know, it takes two or three scenes to pay off the Mr. Big sequence. You know, all of this kind of, it's done over stages, and it's something that I think comedy's kind of lost focus on recently. But do you find this to be a lost art form, or do you think that this even follows that art form? Are you seeing a different use of the comedy here?
Oh, you do make me sad that the set up joke and then doesn't pay off for several scenes is kind of... But I blame that on a lot of these cheapy comedies and making bad comedians trying to make movies, but...
Well, I mean, the thing is that comedy on television has gotten so damn good over the last few years. You know, it's really surprising how comedy in film has really kind of dropped the ball. You know, we're in the age of Arrested Development and Modern Family. I mean, say what you will about the current seasons, but when it first came out, it was pretty, you know, head on. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, you know, for, you know, the more hardcore type, you know, comedy has really come a long way, and yet film just kind of, it's like, you know, we have to do something really gross, really vulgar,
right.
really obnoxious.
You have to go for the R rating or skirt it, or else it's not funny. And yeah. And you know, you could do that with set up jokes, but they go straight into the punch. So it's,
you know, one
more
things...
bodily fluids. No more. I don't want any more.
Seriously.
Bodily fluids.
Yeah. Well, actually,
that's
they were. I mean, to bring it back to Wayne's World, when they're outside the donut place, they were thinking about having him hurl, and they're like, "No, it's not.
The tease is good enough. That's all you need,
and not be as funny. And yeah, it's the right choice."
Yeah.
Yeah, I absolutely get what you're saying, man. I really do. I think the joke of he needs coffee and chaser's stat is a lot funnier than seeing him hurl.
Yeah. No, it is funny to say if you're gonna spewing this and hand a really tiny cup to somebody. That's funny. As
well,
long as
because
you don't
you're
show
thinking
it.
About it.
Yeah.
It's, you don't see it. You're thinking it.
And you're like,
and,
yeah. And for the next year, you're handing people cups saying if you're going to spew.
Well, it's just, again, it's the imagery. It's one of the, it kind of brought me back to a movie that I just saw recently for like the 500th time, which was Dr. Strangelove.
There's
a sequence where a guy is talking about how he's come to this this notion that the world needs to end because of impotency. We don't see it, but the way that he describes his impotency is funnier than seeing it. So to me, that's the thing. Is like if you can get away with just it, comedy is almost kind of like the opposite of every other thing, every other knowledge about film, which is show it, you know, show it, don't see it, say it. In comedy, it's funnier if you say it, don't show it. It's funnier if you leave it in the mind of the audience, what happened. You know, like one of the things that I think was a major detriment to the Hangover movie was that it didn't leave a lot to the imagination. Just hint at things. Don't show it. Don't over-explain it. Just hint at it and let the audience decide what to do with that information. You know, it was interesting because one of those comedies that did it, or at least in the first movie, that this movie kind of almost made a reference to, which was Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle. Some of the stuff that was said in that film are things that we never see. You know, it's things that are left just in the background. And at the same time, though, if you over-explain it, if you over-show it, if you overplay your hand for a cheesy sight gag, you're messing up what could be something that would be extremely memorable.
It's
you know,
it's weird when you bring it up like that because it gets me thinking that horror and comedy have that in common. It's better if it's better if you don't see it. You can talk about it and let it exist in the viewer's mind, and then don't show it, don't do it, or do it off camera, and it works. The impact's better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and it's one of those things, like, and this was one of the very few takeaways I got from the audio commentary when I was listening to Penelope Spheris, because for the most part, her commentary was kind of scattershot. But one thing that I really took away from it was the fact that she was saying, we could not do this. We were aiming for a PG-13,
yeah,
and we were too afraid of a rated R. So we couldn't do a lot of these kind of sight gags because we were afraid of getting rated R. And I think that having that restriction actually did more to make the film more interesting to watch, because if it would have gone to those sight gags, and this is something that would actually be to the detriment of practically every other Saturday Night Live movie ever since, because they would do everything wrong that Wayne's World did right, in my opinion, at least. Yeah, they left themselves. This film would have been just another awful comedy if they would have decided to go the gross sour gag. And Chris, I think you would agree with me on this one, at least, right?
Well, does puke automatically result in an R rating?
I don't exactly know. It's one of those things. Like, I think that when it comes to Lorne Michaels, he's one of those individuals that really, he doesn't like to fight. And I don't think that he was eager to get into a dispute with the MPAA, which is notoriously finicky about anything.
Yeah.
So.
And I also think Lorne Michaels has an attitude of, can I put this on TV as is?
Mm-hmm.
And puke might not fit in a lot of time frames for that. So you'd be like, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I totally get the whole, like, leaving things to the viewer's imagination, because that's like a forgotten art form in itself. But I also think of the barf scene in Team America, and that was amazing.
Well, that was
fantastic
art
to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so that's what
hard
I was
art,
also
but
thinking.
But Team America is playing off of one gag that Wayne's World doesn't, which is the fact that this is all coming from puppets. So in itself,
right,
seeing puppets puke is something that in itself is not, is going to be kind of, your brain's going to have to register that.
Yeah.
If you see live action people puking, you're not registering that. You're just thinking, oh, that's gross. You know, that there's no, there's nothing to offset that. The offset of a puppet, like, oh, it's a puppet that's puking. What the hell? I mean, you don't think of that. You don't see that coming.
How can puppets even puke? I don't get it.
I mean, that's also the reason why the sex scene works in Team America you know, if we had the gratuitous sex scene that was kind of hinted at in this movie.
Well, it was there. I mean, it said right there, gratuitous sex scene. There it is. So,
mm-hmm.
Which I believe is permitted in PG-13. So.
Yeah, as long as it's tidy whities.
Yeah, which he was in, and so that's, I mean, there's a great example of having a mental image that, like, you didn't want, but at the same time, you made it funny. So, happy birthday. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, and that was all Mike Myers, apparently. So
yeah.
That was, all right, we have to talk about Mike Myers, because apparently, apparently he is extremely well known for being one of the most difficult people to work with, which shows just how an amazing a director that Jay Roach is, considering that he was able to get to do, you know, 3 Austin Powers movies without killing Mike Myers once. Or if he has, he was successful to reanimate him at some point. But apparently he was a real shit in this movie. He made it very difficult for everybody. I mean, Dana Carvey apparently had a few diva moments himself, but nothing to the extent of Mike Myers. In fact, the reason why Penelope Spheris didn't come back for Wayne's World 2 was that Mike Myers blocked her from ever coming back. he held it against her that a lot of his the things that he wanted in the movie, she kind of maneuvered out of the film, and he took it very personally. And so he made sure to get a director who wouldn't be so independent to come back and to mess with what he was doing. And if you notice, if you've ever seen Wayne's World 2, it basically flates Wayne. It makes Wayne out to be practically God. So,
Wayne Stark, yes.
Yeah.
And it does kind of explain Aerosmith's presence, because Alice Cooper was in this movie because of the director. Mm-hmm. She's like, who do I get for this? I could get Aerosmith, but they've already been on the TV show. So it was between Ozzy and Alice Cooper. And she's like, and I think it was basically Alice Cooper got back first, or Ozzy was busy or something.
And like, interesting enough, Ozzy would be doing Austin Powers 3.
Yeah.
So, go figure.
Yeah.
But I will say though, Alice Cooper, that was brilliant. That sequence was amazing in the sense that you did not expect that coming. There was no way that you could see basically a history lesson on Milwaukee getting in a rock concert. It was just. And the fact that apparently this is the real life Alice Cooper. Alice Cooper is an intellectual. It was brilliant. It was amazing. Again, it defied expectation. It was absurd. You know, and this is coming off of a near shot for shot remake of the Laverne and Shirley opening.
which really dates this movie and doesn't age it well. Makes it. I mean,
no,
young people would be like, "What the hell is this?" It's like they're making fun of a popular '70s, late early '80s show. Like, yes, they are. They're doing it perfectly.
It was amazing. Too. I'm sorry, yeah. I love this. And understand, I wasn't really, I didn't know a whole lot about Laverne and Shirley before seeing this movie, but then I seen Laverne and Shirley after this. And then I caught the joke, like,
oh my god, like the opening,
Shamil, Shalmazel, All right. The only thing, though, is that it would have been awesome if they had been able to find a way to get Michael McKean and what's his name to come back as Ziggy and Squiggy.
Yeah.
That would have been awesome. And they would have also tied us back to Spinal Tap, you know, with Michael McKean. Yeah. So, got to do that. All right. So, let's talk about the ending.
The ending? Oh, I wanted to talk about Stacey. Okay.
All right, you want to talk about Stacey right quick?
The psycho ex-girlfriend trope taken to such an extreme.
I'll just say one thing. If an ex-girlfriend gives you a gun rack for a present, what is that exactly exemplifying there? What do you think is being said about this?
That she's mental. Hello. mental?
Do you really want to tell your ex-boyfriend to think about guns when they're trying to get away with you from you? I mean, seriously, that's like a really bad idea. I mean, thankfully he doesn't own a gun. Yeah. Much less more than one that would require a whole rack for him.
Yeah.
But I will say, though, that this is the scene that shows that Wayne is a bit of a dick, right? Because the way that he deals with Stacey in that first scene is pretty brutal. I mean,
if this has been going on for weeks after they've broken up, I could see snappage happening. It's like,
we broke up!
Go away! No,
it's true, but at the same time, though, the thing is that everyone sees this kind of lighthearted, fun, goofy side of him. With Stacey, we see he can be a pretty big dick at times, and that actually does kind of help us when we get to the end, when we see him picking fights with both Benjamin and Cassandra and Garth. You know, And so, you know, it kind of shows that, you know, that he does have kind of a breaking point, and he can, you know, he isn't immune to being a dick at times. Right?
It shows the character is possible of having that in their character.
Yeah. Or is this just really his personality that's coming through, that he's really just an asshole with a really nice facade? I mean, he isn't in the entertainment business, you know? Just
yeah. Are you saying that Garth is the one that really is the good one of the whole group?
Garth is the gimp. In this relationship. Come on, seriously. You put him in a suit, he would act the exact same way.
Okay, I asked my daughter about this today, because it's like, have you seen Wayne's World? She's like, yeah. Okay, what was your view of it? Yay! Like, oh, come on. No. No. Like.
Yeah.
But she agreed about the YouTube thing, about it being YouTube before YouTubers. So, yeah.
Well, but Wayne and Garth, it kind of also has this kind of Jay and Silent Bob kind of hetero life mate element to them a bit. I can kind of see where she's coming from. And there is a bit, it's not a huge homoerotic element between the two, but there is some of that in there. I mean, they do. You know, he does kind of bring up the fact that, you know, he has funny feelings when climbing up the rope in the gym shorts.
And he had funny thoughts when he saw Bugs Bunny dressed as a girl.
Which was actually an ad-lib.
It's an ad-lib,
had Mike Myers in tears, apparently.
Yeah, because the scene where we actually see, the cut where we see Mike Myers laughing is in response to another ad-lib, because the ad-lib for that one, he was too broken up to actually use the take. So, when you have to take time off for filming because your ad-libs are that good.
I mean, he is really damn good at that. I mean, just gonna say, I mean, like I said, he's capable of really good comedy. Say you will, Chris, but
that generation of SNL had a lot of comedians who did not age well with their comedy. I mean, look, one guy is a Republican and one guy is a Democratic senator from that era. So come on.
that entire class of Saturday Night Live is a very interesting one. That I would love to talk about in full, because that was one of the weirdest group. And that's saying something, considering the drugged out first class that we had. And those guys, wow. When you find out the behind the scenes of what happened during those first 5 years, you're surprised any of them lived to see their 40s.
Yeah.
You know, that was fucked up what those guys did. And what that show allowed them to get away with. You know, with behind the scenes. Like, I think what it was, Jane Curtin came out and was, like, talking about it recently. And
doesn't understand how everybody's alive. No,
I don't think she does.
Yeah.
But, again, you know, Saturday Night Live classes, the most successful ones, those have got some weird-ass stories. And that one specifically was pretty weird. I mean, yeah. R.I.P. Bill Hartman on that.
And the first,
but we also need to talk about another R.I.P. that we had in here. We have Chris Farley.
His first movie role right here.
Yep. They basically exposition number one. It would have been funny if that would have been his character name in the movie, was exposition number one.
Isn't it just security guard or something?
It's like, it's not auspicious that we get this information from a security guard, like, right now.
That was awfully convenient.
Because, again, in some movies, I think that this film, you have to earn being able to call out exposition like this. Because if it just happens without earning it, it just feels forced and contrived and you just roll your eyes. And I have a feeling that some of us might actually be still rolling their eyes on this one. But
true.
In my opinion, though, by this particular point, it... don't give your opinion too early. No, we want to have some suspense. I think that this film definitely does. It has earned by that point that you expect it at this point. It's done so much so far, and it's been able to kind of set the terms of its own movie by this point. That yeah, they can call out, oh, this is basically exposition. Without it seeming forced, it's basically having fun with the with film conveniences, especially comedy conveniences. I'm actually kind of going back to 80s comedies and thinking about kind of how this movie is making fun of those. Like at this particular point, if I'm not correct, it was 2003. I was thinking of The Naked Gun, but that one's a year later. That would kind of pull some of the same things here. Other 80s comedies, I want to say, Beverly Hills Cop specifically, that this movie is kind of playing off of those and saying, and kind of just having fun with the tropes and the conveniences that this kind of stuff had done for so long and kind of taking a wink at it, right? Or do you think it's not doing it very well?
It winks almost too hard at times.
You think so?
And a lot of the... Well, we made a reference earlier about Uwe and Shuri being dated. A lot of this stuff is dated. And the weird thing was, they expected the Terminator thing to be the one that nobody would get in later years. And that's the one everybody gets! Everybody's like, yeah, because the Terminator franchise just kind of went, oh yeah, we know who he is, we know what's going on here. The other stuff, I mean, the brand still exists for the most part, but Little, Yellow, sorry, that's...
Yep, the Grey Poupon joke?
Yeah, I mean, that, do they still run commercials like that?
No.
Okay. I wasn't sure about that.
I don't even think Grey Poupon is still around.
I think I've seen it.
It's still around.
Yeah. They just don't treat it as, pardon me. But yeah, Pizza Hut, Doritos, the whole Garf joke.
It's the choice of a new generation, man.
Well, and you know, that would have been, that's a very Gen X thing, because that was pointed at my people. Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, that's, oh my God.
What I think is specifically funny, and again, you know, this is one of those that is definitely going to be one of the more dated jokes about this, is the fact that they were actually basically doing the exact commercials of that time.
Right.
You know,
right.
That was
that
the
was
Pizza
the
Hut commercial of that time. That was the Pepsi commercial of that kind. The
Reebok
commercial.
That was the Doritos commercial, was you hold the bag up and you do the exaggerated reach in. And that's, it's, but even though it's dated, you could tell what they're doing, and it's still kind of funny today, because like, hi, I've got a product, because we're all aware today of product placement.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And going, oh yeah, how much did they pay for that? How much did they pay for that? How much did they, here it's like, here, in your face, it's not subtle, see? That's
but
way
it's
better.
Also... But again, it's the irony of the fact that this is Wayne and Garth basically saying, no, we're not going to change our format for a sponsor because we're not going to sell out, while basically selling out the scene, which is the joke inside the joke that's inside the joke. This is the Russian dolls of jokes at this particular point.
It's the meta joke. Wayne and Garth would never sell out, but Mike Myers considering would say to Carvey in a heartbeat. Yeah.
Well, not just that. I mean, this is a Saturday Night Live skit that has been turned into a Hollywood feature.
Right.
This is, I mean, you couldn't ask for more of a sellout. I mean, hell, you know, we had adaptation that came out in 2002 about a book that was being made for to be made a movie that was never meant to be made into a movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's about flowers. You know, is that that movie makes point. And I did have a bit of an adaptation moment here, and I think that considering that Charlie Kaufman had worked in television around that time, I don't think he worked on Saturday Night Live, but I'm pretty sure that if you were to ask him, he might have been aware of some of the stuff that was happening with Wayne's World around when he was working in Hollywood, and that that had a part to play in some of the meta humor that he made for that particular film, which I don't know if either of you seen that movie or not, but watch it after watching Wayne's
Great
World.
Great movie.
Yes.
Great movie.
Love it. But yeah, but part of me does kind of think that, that this is, that, that Wayne's World is kind of on that same meta level when it's talking in this, in these meta terms a bit. And especially when you get to the endings. Can we talk about the endings? Let's talk about the endings. I got to talk about the endings. This, again, okay. this changed a lot of what I thought about movies at the time. The fact that you could do something like this and get away with it, and it actually worked. So let's start off. Do you think that there is a definitive ending? Is one of these three endings the definitive ending? And points to the one who says the Scooby-Doo ending.
Oh, well, wait a minute.
Well, let's put it this way. Rubble was not in the sequel. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Well, if you look, well, if you consider the sequel to be completely canon, to be the absolute definitive, yes, this is what happens next, then Scooby-Doo or Super Happy could be the definitive. Because Wayne and Cassandra are still together, and, you know, they've still got the show, they're still working.
Unless you think Wayne's World 2 is a drug-fueled fever dream by Wayne about the life that he should have had. Considering that he
more
is
likely
hallucinating Jim Morrison in that movie.
Yeah.
Just saying. Just saying.
Okay, that's getting beyond the meta. So it's getting too dark for Wayne's World.
I could build a theory on that. I could. I could build a theory on
that. You could, but let's not today. So put it on your YouTube channel. That would be, I believe, movie.
All right, fine.
Yeah, so.
But no, but so
yeah, Scooby-Doo
or Super Happy ending, huh?
I'm trying to think how Scooby-Doo could not be a definitive ending, except that we never really saw any advantage for Old Man Smithers and his haunted.
Old Man Withers.
Old Man Withers. So close to, you know, every other Scooby-Doo villain.
And they actually set up Old Man Withers at the coffee shop on the
day. How's the amusement park? Going great. Like, okay. So, it just doesn't.
Like I said, this thing builds. This thing ties up a lot of the loose threads, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. But I prefer, you know, kind of super happy, but nah. There's almost like a fourth ending would have been reality when you consider the sequel. Super happy, but not as joyous and carefree.
Oh, you mean the fade to black ending that if you've seen at the end of the credits?
Are they just going to fade to black? I think so. Let's just sit here until they do.
I can't believe they did that.
That, yeah. Which is great post-credits within the credits. So, you know, you sit there, you're watching the credits so people get credited, and, you know, and then, meanwhile, you get extra Wayne and Garth. Excellent.
Well, it just, you know, because let's be honest here, we think of something this meta, you have to think Deadpool, right?
Right.
Because,
yep.
Yeah, this film and Deadpool play on the meta elements so strong, and yet, while I do love the Ferris Bueller's ripoff on Deadpool in a way. I predicted that that was the end credits scene. I don't know why. I don't know why I thought it was going to be Ferris Bueller's, but I knew it was going to be Ferris Bueller's. But part of me did also kind of wish that it was the Wayne's World ending. The idea of that, you know, that Deadpool would not want his movie to end and then to have it fade to black and go, son of a bitch.
That would have fit really well. Really, that would have been amazing, actually.
You just sit here. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just saying. And who knows, you know, there is a Deadpool 2, so that, you know, they might go that direction this time.
It'd be pretty great.
The super happy ending, what I absolutely love about that is the fact that even when everyone gets all the happiness and, you know, the whole gang gets together and they're all, you know, everyone's learned their lesson, and then they basically just kind of laugh at the camera at the end. It's, you know, kind of mocking the audience a bit.
The Jay and Silent Bob Strikes Back moment where it's like, who would pay for a Jay and Silent Bob movie? And nobody looks at the camera.
Mm-hmm. Oh boy.
Who would pay for a Wayne and Garth movie?
They'd buy it twice.
They'd buy it 8 times. I mean, Jesus Christ, how many times? Yeah, I wish I remembered how many times I went.
So does that make Lorne Michaels Noah's Arcade of SNL? You know, it's like,
well, we got to the next level. Noah doesn't allow you to go to the next level. We watched the movie, we're entertained, therefore our entertainment was the next level. We got what we paid for.
I don't know if you've seen any of the other SNL movies.
Yeah, well, okay. If you want to rank SNL movies, we have to do Blues Brothers at some point, just to compare it to
Blues
this.
Brothers technically is a SNL movie, but it's not really. It's kind of,
I know it is, but it isn't.
It's like the Foxverse in comparison to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's its own thing. Yeah. It doesn't really tie into the others.
If you consider it one of them, then you're in a great debate as to whether or not it's this movie or it's Blues Brothers or Wayne's World is the best SNL movie.
Yeah.
If you leave it out, then yeah, there's no way. I mean, I think I've met somebody that would try and argue Night at the Roxbury of all movies could be close to it, but I'm even like, maybe because it's not as bad as Coneheads, or, you know, or...
do know that you're basically wondering which tastes better, the shit sandwich or the douche soup at this point, right?
Diarrhea soup.
Yeah, it's... Yeah.
No, that would be Superstar.
I actually saw Superstar in theaters. I didn't pay for it, thankfully, but I saw it in theaters, and I want my hour and a half back.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are far... Yeah.
yeah, Saturday Night Live has not made a whole lot of great movies. In fact, I will say that, arguably, with the exception of Wayne's World and Blues Brothers, I can't even recommend any of them outside of that.
I'm trying to... They haven't had a real good hit in a few years to even try again that I can think of, so...
Mm-hmm.
I'm lost. I think all their... Actually, I think part of the problem is their talent that had good skit things left to do other stuff before Lorne Michaels could say, hey, let's do a movie of this! And they're like, nope, we're already elsewhere, bye!
Yeah, I mean, say what you will about Austin Powers. I have very mixed feelings about it, but it was very successful, and it did become pop culture in itself, and that happened after Mike Myers left SNL. Say what you will about Will Ferrell. I mean, his Hollywood career happened after he left SNL. Yep.
Your female weekend update cast went and did great TV away from SNL. So,
mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
All right, so let's go ahead and let's start wrapping this up. Is there anything we want to bring up before we go to Geek Sheet?
Well, do you think this should have been the sequel? Does anybody think this should have been? Or was it the quest for more money?
Honestly,
is that really a question?
Yes.
If you're able to get Mike Myers' head out of his own ass, and would have been willing to be more critical of Wayne specifically, because I think that the one of the reasons why Wayne's World works on the level that it does is the fact that Wayne is an asshole, and the film admits that he's an asshole, and that you know, that so. Character growth, as much as character growth as you can have in something as absurd as this, does kind of come with him trying to become better or trying to be the best person he can be. Where Wayne's World 2 doesn't have that character growth, it's basically him doing his version of the Doors.
Yeah.
And that's...
And trying to create Woodstock as a glorious thing in his image.
Yeah, it's basically just self-like. Now, don't get me wrong, there are great sequences in Wayne's World 2. Yeah. You know, the kung fu sequence alone that occurs between Wayne and Cassandra's father, played by the amazing James Hong, by the way, is just absolutely hilarious. There are other great sequences in Wayne's World too, but it definitely the overall tone of the film was so self-congratulatory that even the audiences were just kind of like, you know, they didn't come to this one with the same amount of strength that the original did. So I think that there could have been a great sequel, but it would have required Mike Myers to kind of ease some of the control that he had on the character and allowed his character to kind of develop a little bit. But that's just my opinion. I could, you know, I'm probably on the minority on this one.
I'd have to see two again to see if it really doesn't go up.
It's a good movie. Don't get me wrong. It's one that you can enjoy.
And
if you liked Wayne's World, then Wayne's World 2 is kind of more the same. And it does, you know, it's not as great as Wayne's World because it's more aware than ever, and it doesn't play on this. It doesn't have that same kind of freshness that the first one has. But you can, if you're not into Wayne's World, and I can tell that one of us isn't into Wayne's World, you're
me.
More than You're not going to enjoy Wayne's World at all. It's going to be basically the same kind of thing. And so, yeah. But that's what I have to say about the sequel. Honestly, I would say it would be kind of cool maybe to have... If, you know, maybe if Mike Myers finds some humility, maybe if they brought Wayne's World back... for one more turn, I think it would be interesting, especially in the digital age. Could you imagine Wayne and Garth, you know, in their 50s, trying to do a YouTube channel?
Actually, no. This would be Wayne and Cassandra's child.
No.
That's how you do it.
The whole child thing is...
I know. That would be next generation-ish. That's how you could continue. Of course, you'd be continuing kind of about...
So, would the child be played by Justin Timberlake by any chance?
Too old. Find somebody who's actually like 20 years old.
Oh God!
He is Canadian.
Kill that project right there. It's dead. It's dead.
He's Canadian, but no.
It's dead. You just killed that with one word or two words right there.
Yeah. So,
I think we can crown the new killer of fun now.
But yeah, Wayne and Cassandra's child with, you know, the Garth and Dream Girl's child, Dream Woman's child.
All right. All right, let's go ahead and let's get into Geek Sheet right quick.
Oh, this God, is going to This
be
is
an
so
interesting
deep.
One. All right, Kent, go on. You know which ones you want to talk about. Do it now.
I'll save my big one for the end, but Dream Woman is actually Dan Aykroyd's wife.
Mm-hmm.
Which is bizarre, weird. Okay. The waitress who they have at the beginning is like, "Oh, you guys sick of ordering the same stuff?" Was Mike Myers' girlfriend and then wife and now ex-wife. Mm-hmm. But
I wonder why.
Yeah, well, who knows. My big one, though, was when I realized, hey, it's Michael DeLuise of the DeLuise clan as one of the guys. And, hey, he's on my favorite fake TV show in a TV show. And basically he was in Stargate as
mm-hmm.
playing the fictionalized version of Colonel O'Neill, except he's right.
Yeah. And you know
over
how
the top.
He got that job,
way
right?
over the top. His brother was the main director.
Yep.
On most of Stargate, it's Michael's brother. So, the DeLuise clan does a lot of stuff. So, but I think this is one of his earliest, really, in there. So, and there's just a lot of guys that are like, incidentally, they're people who know people or who knew the director. I mean, a lot of them backstage at the concert, just the extras or people Penelope knows. And it's like, you want to be backstage at Alice Cooper? You want to be backstage at this concert? Doing what? Acting like you're backstage. That's it. Just like, mm-hmm. Oh, okay. So.
Nepotism at its finest.
Well, yeah. Well, it's very convenient for extras in... If you need extras who need to know, be doing nothing stuff. And know mm-hmm. what they're doing is they're doing nothing stuff. Hey, you can just stand there and do what you would normally be doing. Okay.
Yeah?
Yeah. That's
all right.
Good.
So I got one big one. That I'll bring up, and that is the cinematographer for this film.
Yes.
Is Teo Vondesson. Now, most people don't know who Teo Vondesson is. I don't expect them to because he's a cinematographer. For me, though, this is the guy who was the cinematographer for movies like Blade. He was the cinematographer for, I won't hold this against him, but he was the cinematographer for most of the Adam Sandler films of the New Line variety. Yes, but you can't blame him. It's not his fault. He can't, you know.
Sorry.
Oh, wow. But, no, he also did, Cruel Intentions. He did, High Crimes, Out of Time. He's done quite a bit of work all across the 80s, 90s, and the 2000s. In fact, he's still running strong. Let's see here. I guess the last thing that he's really done was Bad Santa 2, which, well, say what you will about the movie. It's awful, but...
But if it's shot
well,
well,
yeah. I'll give you that much. But no, Blade, in my opinion, is considering that, especially that he uses a lot of darks, blacks, and reds in that. I thought it was pretty good. So anyway, all right. So gentlemen, let's go ahead and let's call it, shall we? Kent, Chris, do you agree with the critics on Wayne's World? Do you give it a pass? Do you give it a fail? Or do you give it a maybe? Let's go with the most suspenseful one. Chris!
Some of the jokes did still hit home for me. Like the Cantonese scene, the first one that you guys are talking about. That one was really good to me. The sponsor scene was great. With Dana Carvey, my favorite scene with him was the... where he treats the flashlight like a gun. I thought that was pretty great. But the rest of the film just does not age well. I remember when I watched it a few years ago, I thought it was still pretty funny. I did not laugh at all this time I watched it. I just feel like it's past its prime. It's no good now. I gotta go with a fail. It's just my thing. Yeah, yeah.
That's okay.
I'm also the youngest one here, so that probably has to say a lot well. So
perhaps. Yeah. Perhaps.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, Kent.
Well, as I've mentioned before, looking on it in today's view, parts of this movie did not age well. And parts of it don't quite work without an understanding of the time, which borderlines it into maybe. But I have such love for this movie from the ancient times, and it takes me back so much that... And a lot of the jokes and a lot of the... just how things are set up is still very funny. And still gets me going. So, it may be nostalgia talking. It probably is. But a lot of it is nostalgia talking. But I'm still passing it. It makes me feel good. It makes me want to be young again. It makes me want to go to metal shows and like little places. And yeah. Okay.
All right. So I guess for me, I really want to distance myself from nostalgia when watching this particular film. And I want to look at it specifically on its own terms. And so I'm looking at it not just as a comedy contemporary, but also a comedy of its time, as a 90s comedy specifically. What does it say about the 90s? And the thing is that this isn't just really about the 90s. It's kind of talking about the 80s. It's talking about the 70s a bit. It's talking about metal, but it's not really a big metal movie. It's kind of metal light in a little bit. I don't care what the director says about how metal this movie is. It's not. You know, it's interesting to see, you know, the likes of Meatloaf and Alice Cooper in this movie. It's got all of this elements, but it's also kind of a Saturday Night Live comedy. And on the terms of a Saturday Night Live comedy, this is really good in that sense, if you're looking at it from that curve. As a comedy in itself, I honestly think that it's brilliant, but it's also one of those that maybe you have to have a little bit of an understanding of the 90s specifically. I'm not saying that you have to be of the 90s, but you have to understand the 90s as kind of a pop culture era. And in that sense, if you have to have that understanding for it to resonate, that's going to kind of diminish the return, because you can't expect anyone to notice this. It's just like making a 1940s comedy about the 40s, and if you don't have any point of reference, you're not going to get it. And in that sense, yeah, I can definitely understand why people wouldn't catch on to this and wouldn't hold on to it as much as I do. I still think this is brilliant. I think the absurdist comedy is something that is a bit timeless in itself. But overall, it's not one of the great comedies of all time for me anymore. It was of its time. But at the same time, for what it is, it works on that level. So I am going to give it a pass for the sense of what it is doing. Do I think other movies do it a bit better? Absolutely. But for what it is, I still say give it a shot. You might find it to be really funny. If you don't, then just don't go looking for other Saturday Night Live movies. There's nothing but heartache
there.
Anyway. You're only going to find heartache.
Let me do this. Blues Brothers and Wayne's World are it.
That's it. Do not go any further. And it is arguable whether you're going to like those movies either.
What?
A lot of people put a lot of stuff on Blues Brothers. I've actually met people who do not like Blues Brothers.
They're probably Illinois Nazis, because I hate Illinois Nazis.
I have a strange feeling that at some point we are going to be running around Illinois in a souped-up police car with a half pack of cigarettes and wearing shades at night at some point.
Yes.
Just not anytime soon.
Oh, thank God.
No, we'll soon! We must do it soon! No,
No.
All right.
I haven't seen it for this long, so you know.
Don't worry, Chris. We're gonna step away from the comedy for just a little bit. We are going to head on south to a little border town just outside of Texas for our next movie, which is one of those weird movies that it's great and critics have been loving it, but it disappeared off the map about 10 years ago. And I think that we need to have a talk about it. So we are going to be talking about the 1996 John Sayles film Lone Star on our next episode. This will be the beginning of the McConaissance. This is the film that put Matthew McConaughey on the map and would get him his first big role. And I'm going to say right now, it's going to be a very interesting discussion, to say the least. So... All right.
Okay.
All right. Any last words, gentlemen? Or do you feel like you can follow up on that?
Well, are we going to do a Scooby-Doo ending? No? Okay.
No, it was Chris the entire time, okay?
Yes. Yeah.
And you wouldn't have gotten away with it, too. All right. This is the Movie Derek.
This is Kent.
And this is Chris.
And Phoenix.